Programming is supported by Topline Construction Firm, your local women-owned roofing contractor based out of Shoreview, Minnesota. Roof replacement, both retail and insurance work. More information at toplineconstructionfirm.com.
You're listening to a recording of a live radio show on NPR News. If you want to listen to us in real time, you can stream our show live weekdays at 9 and 11 a.m. Central. Thanks for listening and enjoy the show.
I'm Carrie Miller. This is NPR News. Last week, the Federal Reserve Bank of Minneapolis hosted a conference on innovation in early childhood education. We were struck by what some of the experts there said about the economic benefits of investing in early childhood development, kind of tangential to what we were talking about this hour. The panel was moderated by our NPR News education reporter, Elizabeth Shockman, and the guests were Mary Brainerd, former president and CEO for Minnesota-based Health Partners, Huey Nguyen, assistant commissioner in the Minnesota Department of Education, and Art Rolnick, senior fellow at the Humphrey School of Public Affairs at the U of M. Mr. Rolnick starts us off talking about his research into the economic benefits of investing in early education.
I wanted the business community in particular, but generally the public, to think about early childhood development as economic development. You know, I had railed against for many years public funding of private companies. You don't want to get me started on stadiums, but for the last 10 plus years, the state has spent $1 billion on building sports stadiums and arenas. These are private companies. They would have done this anyway in some form or another. And probably what's well-known now to all of you is Amazon headquarters. They're going around, I think they got 20 communities bidding on that headquarters. I think New Jersey's up to $7 billion. Okay, they're going to locate somewhere in the U.S. That's no new jobs. It's a question of moving them around. Where are they going to locate? So Rob and I were claiming we got a much better investment than that. We claimed, in fact, an 18% inflation-adjusted return based on the Perry preschool study. Heckman had a 13% return, but we have double-digit returns from these studies, and we're just making a very simple economic argument. We got a much better public investment because most of the return on investing in our most at-risk kids, the public benefits. So the economic argument we thought was pretty straightforward. Let's look at the best way to invest money. This is your current It's your current workforce, because as you build more early ed programs, you're going to be hiring more teachers, et cetera. And it's your future workforce. So it's real economic development, and it's an economic development that we argued, and no one's disagreed with this, is 15 years later, the best public investment we can make. And I argue it'll create more jobs now and in the future than that Viking stadium over there. So you want real economic development. You want it in the places that need it the most. You want to deal with equity issues, you can't do better than this as an economic investment. The thing I learned the most is this isn't about empowering programs. This is about empowering parents. And if you think about the Minnesota model of early childhood education that we've implemented here, it starts with the parents when we can, prenatal, with a home visiting nurse, maybe triage to another type of parent mentor, but it's very much the Northside Achievement Zone, the NAS model, and the Way to Grow model. I should point out that roughly 70% of the kids in Minnesota start school ready. Poverty kids, it's 30%. Historically, in the Northside Achievement Zone, it was 18%. Well, the Northside Achievement Zone, we're up from 18% to close to 60%. Way to Grow is close to 90%. So we've got results. Okay, so this isn't theory anymore. I know we can get better. And my point to the political system is, not 5 years from now, we don't need more research. Now is the time to fund this for every child born into poverty, for every child born of an incarcerated parent, for every homeless child. We know it's a huge investment, a huge return on investment for the public. And so hopefully in 5 to 10 years, we'll start showing that we can not only close the achievement gap, but if we do this right, and health is a big component of this, we can prevent it.
What are characteristics that you're seeing of programs that are really doing a good job, that are really coming back with these great results?
So the programs that work the best, they start with the parents. And earlier the better. You can't start early enough. Mm-hmm. And so that's the heavy lifting in mind. It's not just simply taking a child and putting them into a pre-K program. this is really about. You want these sustainable results, you get that parent. If you give me an engaged and empowered parent, and we may not get it all right, but we're not going to go too far wrong.
What could you add to that, Mary? What have you learned about in kind of coming around empowering parents, investing, as I really like that phrase that Art said, not investing in a program, investing in parents, investing in people?
Yeah, well, first, I completely agree with Art's points. And I think what I would do is add, first of all, preschool is incredibly important, but the time before preschool is incredibly important. And there are knowledge gaps. All the professionals who deal with tiny children don't know the science. Parents don't. The work in California would say that's a big gap, is young moms just don't know how critical those first 3 years of life are for brain development. And so if we wait till age three, we're actually waiting too long, which is why this earlier part of the program that Art's talking about is so important. And that can be delivered a lot of different ways. But we know that when families have a new baby, they want that baby to do well. They want good things for their child. And sometimes just don't know that the experiences that a child has in the first year of life really set the course for their future life success. And I think understanding the critical nature of that time, and that we're talking about not rocket science kinds of interventions. We're talking about snuggling and cuddling and holding and singing. Those are all things that make a huge difference to a child's future. And we just haven't helped parents see that all the time. So I think that's a thing I would emphasize. It's where healthcare can make some difference, because we see lots of families lots of times during a pregnancy and the early months after a child is born. But churches do too, and other childcare organizations do too, and schools do too, and community organizations do too. And I sometimes think one of the things that's currently standing in the way is there's a lot of fragmentation. So approaches that help parents make decisions and get connected, really important. That's one of the strengths of NAS, is making those connections. It's where you'd like to see huge scale implementation of things that we know can help. You know, ending remarks on this topic, I just say there are four things that UNICEF calls out worldwide as indicative of a country that's committed to kids. One is support for breastfeeding. And we're doing better on that, but we're not doing nearly as good a job as we could in supporting breastfeeding for moms. The second is making sure that families have six-month parental leave. That's happening lots of places, not happening here. The third one is making sure that all kids, data is used to identify kids at high risk, and making sure that there's an intervention to support those kids. That's Art's point. And we're not really doing that very reliably either. And then the fourth point is making sure that kids have universal access to 2 years of pre-K education. So are very many countries doing that? No. But are some countries doing parts of that? Yes. The U.S., zero. Zero of four. I think that's something we need to change for our future. And it's why, for me, it's got to be knowledge, awareness, social change, and action.
I want to go back to something Mary said about access to programs, access to resources, and how complex that can sometimes be. The Minnesota Office of the Legislative Auditor recently found that Minnesota's early childhood programs were complex and fragmented. As the child of a preschooler who's tried to figure out what's available out there, I can concur. It can be confusing. How are you thinking about this? How are you thinking about communicating with other departments? How are you thinking about communicating with parents?
So I will say ditto. As a mom of two young children living in the suburbs as well, it is a maze. So I will say I use the Parent Aware rating system myself.
There you go.
My kids also went to public preschool, so I utilize both systems. Yeah. We have more programs than we ever did. The thing is, they all sprung up really quickly. And so almost every year, every other year, there was a new program developed. There was a new funding model developed. There was something, and nobody was really taking the time to really assess the entire landscape again and saying, does this make sense? Why did we create this other program that is almost exactly like the other program that we have, except for one or two different requirements? Why did we do that? And so I think we kind of, I don't think we should stop by any means. We have great momentum, but we do kind of have to kind of just take a step back a little bit and kind of take a look at the entire landscape as a whole.
So this is something all morning we've been talking about, and I've heard you, Art, say that a focus on early childhood development is something that people on both sides of the aisle can get behind. But Minnesota is certainly among those having the debate about what that looks like exactly, how exactly to invest money. And there's a debate about, do we provide programs and services at the same level for everyone? Is this a universal application? Or do we target certain communities based on testing, based on other factors? This is a question that all of you might have something of an answer to. What are we learning about the application of this, I guess, is my question. Universal versus targeted.
Well, I should say I got kind of surprised on this. I thought once we presented this research on at-risk children, it would be a no-brainer, no pun intended there, that we would be investing our limited dollars in our most at-risk kids. All the research says there's a huge return. These are the kids who typically don't, on average, don't finish high school, end up in crime and other problems. This is a huge return to the public. It seemed to me once this research is out there, we're done. And what happened is politically, and I understand this, if this is good for at-risk kids, it sounds like it's good for all kids. And why don't we just do universal? Why don't we do this for everybody? And so I'm well aware that we have in the public space limited dollars. And so the proposal that came out from the teachers union in particular here in Minnesota and other parts of the country is let's do this universal for public school only. Why public school? Because they claim they can do the best job. That was the argument. And so I looked at that and I said, wait a second. We know too much now about brain development. Four is too late. And I don't understand, given that you have to start early, why would you put all your money into that? And given that to do universal for public school only, you need about twice the amount of money we're talking about just to do it for four-year-olds because you're doing it for everybody. And then there was the superintendents of the public schools testified they didn't have the infrastructure, and they need $1 billion or more in infrastructure. So you're going to spend a lot of money on middle-class and upper-middle-class kids, and the return is – the public return is virtually zero. There's some private return there, but the public return is virtually zero once you get there. So that didn't make any sense. And then finally, and when I had this debate with some of the supporters of the universal public school only, I asked them, where did you send your child and your grandchild? Oh, they said Montessori. Yeah. They said language immersion, Joyce preschool. But I said, wait a second. If that's okay for you, for middle class, why wouldn't you allow a poverty family to have that same choice? They could choose public. They could choose Head Start as long as it's four-star rated. But why wouldn't you give them that choice? And I've yet to get a coherent answer on that. We're saying we need all hands on deck. We want parents to have these choices. One size, Scott and I were talking about this, one size doesn't fit all. We know that. We know that from our own kids, one size doesn't fit all. So let these parents figure out with their mentors, working with them, what works for their kid. And my concern, and this is happening in New York City as we're talking, because the mayor, de Blasio, and I'm on his advisory board, they went universal four, and the evidence that I have so far from their staff is it's mostly turning into a white middle-class program because the most at-risk parents aren't taking advantage of it. They don't have the mentors there. They're starting too late. Now they're talking about universal three. They're spending a lot of money, and my concern is they're not going to close any achievement gap, and they're going to come back to guys like me and Heckman and say, ah, see, it failed. And what they're missing the brain development research, they're missing the importance of engaging the parent, they're missing starting at the beginning, they're missing that this is as much about health as it is about education. I would say this, our governor, Governor Dayton, was on both sides of the issue. He helped fund scholarships and he's helped fund some universal programs, but I think that's And I said, okay, fine, let's have a horse race. Let's see the results. We're getting great results on our scholarship kids. We still haven't seen any results on the universal yet. And I suspect we're gonna look awfully good on that metric as well.
Wei and Mary, what could you add to this? What have you learned about these different proposals, the effectiveness of them, and the conditions that make these different approaches effective?
Go ahead. Sure. So, again, I think I agree with parent choice, right? The parents need to find whatever works best for their children. And sometimes it's public schools because of all of the other programming that public schools offer. We, in the preschool program, we also offer, if you are eligible for preschool, you're eligible for English Learner Services. You will have access to special education services. You have access to free lunch, free breakfast. You have access to free transportation. That might be a choice and a need that a parent has. Others might need to go earlier on and do, you know, early childhood special education or early childhood family education, which have those really strong family components to it and really addressing the needs that the parents have. So I think, again, it's, and I just want to say, I think we often talk about the limited resources. I think it's about prioritizing how we spend the funding. You talk all the time about the $1 billion that we've put into football stadiums. We could have reprioritized that and put that into education, into early education. So again, it is, how are we prioritizing the dollars that we have? I don't, for too many years, I've seen a lot of fighting amongst people who all want to do the same thing, who all want to address the needs of our littlest learners. And we've spent so much time fighting each other rather than saying, let's prioritize what we have and let's fund everything that families and children need. And every family, every child is different, and they all need something different.
I like your point of view on that. I don't think this always has to be an either or. I think it can be an and. I'm concerned about solutions that don't get down to birth to age three, because so much happens by age three that if we miss that opportunity, kids start at a disadvantage. And so I want to see solutions that connect with parents, that start earlier, that make sure that people get the services they need for their families from those earliest days and months of life. And if that comes with universal pre-K, I believe that parents need choice. And when I say universal, I mean available to all, not only in a public school. So I hope that that option is available for all families as well, but I really want to see those little ones get a great start in life.
The view there of Mary Brainerd, former president and CEO of Health Partners, talking about her vision for investing in early childhood development. If you missed part of the panel, you can hear it. It'll be online later today.
This was a recording of a live radio show on NPR News. To add your voice to our discussion, you can call in at 800-242-2828 or tweet Carrie at KERRINPR. And if you miss us live, you'll find all of our shows by subscribing to this podcast. If you have questions, you can email us at talk@npr.org.